We Have Issues is a weekly podcast full of reviews of comics and oversharing. We use grown-up language to make very childish jokes. You can find the show at wehaveissues.net, as well as anywhere else where average to not too bad podcasts can be found. Hello, listener, and welcome to We Have Issues 89. This is a podcast about comics, and I'll be talking about comics in a minute. It is just me in the studio today for various reasons, which I won't bore you with right now because they're boring and I don't really understand them anyway because I'm not really very organized. If you want to listen to any of our previous episodes, many of which have more than one of us in the studio, you can do that by going to wehaveissues.net, or you can subscribe to us in your podcatcher of choice. You can choose whichever one you want. I use Pocket Casts. Other people use iTunes, although it's a bit rubbish. If you do like the podcast, you can always rate and review us on your podcatcher, and that's good. Or you can comment on the wehaveissues.net post for this episode, or you can talk to us on Twitter. We're at IssuesPod, all one word, or I'm Nick Sight, N-I-X-S-I-G-H-T. We do have a page on Facebook. That's at We Have Issues as well. Just search for that and you'll find it. So you can talk to us there, or I sometimes post stuff about comics on there too. What else is there? Oh, yes. If you do want to support us beyond just rating and reviewing or retweeting whenever we post about an episode or anything like that, you can do that by going to patreon.com/TOTP and donating as much as you want a month. It supports both this podcast and the other one that James and I do. It's called Two Grown Men. The schedule on that is a little bit erratic. This is every week, which is a bit more reliable. And thank you. If you are already a patron at Patreon, you're awesome. We love you. Probably better if I don't sound quite so like pat when I say that. You're awesome. And we love you. Now that seems insincere. That seems like I'm really trying hard. Yeah, we just like you. We really appreciate you. If you're listening, we appreciate that. If you're sharing us around, we appreciate that too. If you, patronize us, not patronize us, but patronize us on Patreon, we appreciate that too. It's all good. There are a couple of rewards for people who do pay over a certain amount on Patreon, and you can see what those are if you go to the site. One of the rewards is a monthly episode of sort of a mini special podcast thing that James does with his daughter Scarlett. It's normally a We Have Issues-y thing. They normally talk about a comic or a cartoon or something that they've been into. Even though James and I tend to talk about our kids on the other podcast, but I don't think there are any real hard and fast rules anymore, thinking about it. Again, really should get on top of that. It's not very brand aware, is it? Anyway, because Suicide Squad is coming out, everyone has an opinion about that film and all of the trailers and everything. I'm going to see it eventually. I'm not that fussed one way or the other about any of these movies anymore, really, to be honest. But it has meant that I got to read some interesting... a couple of really interesting articles about the Suicide Squad, the comic, today. One in particular that really caught me wasn't about Suicide Squad specifically. It was about Amanda Waller, who is a character who I realized reading this particular piece, which is called Amanda Waller, DC's Most Terrifying Woman, that I actually read the first appearance of Amanda Waller, even though I've only been peripherally aware of her since then, because she was introduced in an old comic called DC Legends, which was a miniseries back when that was still quite a rare thing. Amanda Waller is distinctive in mainstream comics in general because she's an overweight black woman in a position of authority, and she's always kind of been a peripheral character. She's a major player in Suicide Squad, but she's always been a peripheral character to most other DC books, but she's always been very striking. And this piece by I'm probably going to pronounce this wrong, by Ardo Omer over at Comics Bulletin, really kind of captures what's so cool about her. And it's the sort of writing about comics that I really like, because whether I agree with what's being said or not, whether I understand the appeal of the, you know, if I'm already, I'm not that familiar with Amanda Waller, for example, and whether I like the comics that they're talking about or not, or have a pre-existing relationship with them, I read this piece and now I want to go and read all of those old Suicide Squad comics. It's actually possible. One thing I'm very aware of from listening to a podcast called Travis Bickle on the Riviera is that when people are talking a certain way about art or entertainment or whatever you want to call it, whether they like it or not, whether they like the thing they're talking about or not, they can make you interested in seeing it anyway, which is something I really, really like about that. Now, Ardo Omer clearly does like Amanda Waller, so that's maybe a bad example. But the reason I like this sort of thinking is it's not about whether something is crap or awesome or whatever. It's talking about what's actually there, the substance of a thing, and how that makes the person writing or talking feel. And that's always interesting to me. While I was talking about that piece, and I will put a link to this in the show notes, and I'll put a link to the other piece I'm about to talk about in the show notes as well. While I was talking about this particular post on Twitter earlier on, Stephen Lacey of the Fantasticast, who's a friend of ours, mentioned that there was also a really good oral history of DC's Suicide Squad at Newsarama, which is actually a bunch of the original creators of Suicide Squad in the comics talking about the conception of the comic. Now, that isn't as interesting to me generally. You know, the behind-the-scenes creation of characters isn't as interesting to me as the other sort of writing I was talking about. But it's actually a really interesting piece, and it's, you know, because I'm already interested because I read the previous piece, it was quite nice seeing how this all came about. The problem is that the problem sometimes with knowing how this works, and I've noticed this on episodes of Jay and Miles Explain the X-Men, is that the critical reading that people can do of comics or anything of stories can be quite appealing, and you can read an awful lot of meaning into those things, which, you know, if you can read it in there, it's there, whether it was intended or not, and it might not be there for other people, but it's definitely, you know, a thing. Most academic writing about media is kind of has to take that as a core understanding. But yeah, so critical readings of things can be really, really interesting. But when you actually talk to the people who made a thing about it, quite often a lot of the decisions they made were actually practical and pragmatic and not that emotional at all. It's quite often, especially in comics, it's quite often a bunch of middle-aged men, normally white, making not arbitrary decisions, but like, well, we'd never seen a character like this, so we thought we'd try it, or something. It's like, we thought there'd be a market for it. Oh, this character was available, so we decided to use them. We weren't allowed to use this other character. And there is an element of that which can kind of kill some of the heart of things. There is an element of that to the oral history of DC Suicide Squad. But I'll put a link to that as well, because some of it's also really interesting. Speaking of Explain the X-Men and the increasingly indispensable Jay Edidin, the Jay Edidin sounds a little bit formal and weird, but hopefully you know what I mean. They were getting frustrated on Twitter earlier on about the willful misunderstanding many people have. I think there was a specific person who triggered this, of the difference between a critical reading of a text and the intention of the text itself, which I won't go into too much detail here about, because I'll probably mangle what their intention was. But during the course of that, they linked to a post, a blog called The Middle Spaces, which I believe is the personal blog of, and again, I'm going to probably mangle this, Osvaldo Ayola. I think that's how it's pronounced. It's a post called "I Know It When I See It: Race, Relatability, and Reading Practice." And I really need to dig into it properly. I was reading it on the bus this morning, and it's really accessible, but quite academic. A lot of the stuff being talked about is quite academic and theoretical, and it's about representation in comics. Although the title is race and relatability, I think it's quite general about relatability and reading, how to read texts. And in the part I read at the beginning, it makes this really clear distinction between relatability and identification. Boiled down, I think it's about the different ways we can read things, whether we choose to only read things where we recognize and relate to them directly, or whether we try to work a bit harder with text. And I really need to read it properly because I've really not got very far into it, but I think it's going to be quite interesting. And I'll link to that in the show notes as well, because it might be something that some of you might be interested in. Maybe we can talk about it sometime on the internet or somewhere. God, do I sound uncomfortable? I feel really uncomfortable. We only recorded a show just last week, but I feel all discombobulated. But part of it is that if you've listened to the last few episodes, you'll know that we're kind of struggling with the new studio setup here. That last week's audio was awful, and I'm assuming that isn't going to be the case with this week's, because you have to. But I've no way of knowing until I get there. Also, I'm recording on my own, which is never ideal. I'm conscious that I'm disconnected from what's been going on in comics a little bit this week. Forcibly, I'm assuming there are awful things going on in the comic industry, because there always are. It's not a deliberate effort at self-care, because I'm clearly not very good at retreating to protect myself from things emotionally. Or I don't feel emotions at all, the way normal people do. That's something that, you know, people have said. But so I don't feel as engaged with comics as maybe I should be. But I did read a few comics, and I'll talk to you about those in a little while. Also, I'm standing up because I thought that'd help, but I recently had lunch and I'm feeling a bit clogged up and weird. It's very hot in this studio, and just feeling very weird in my skin. I kind of want to take my t-shirt off, but if someone walks past outside, that's going to be really, really strange for them. We are in a professional working environment after all. I won't take my t-shirt off. We'll keep it on. I'll just stand here sweating. I'm gonna try something. Back in a sec. I'm gonna sit down and
Hello, David Wynn here. Do I need to introduce myself? I draw comics and stuff. I did the theme tune for the podcast. Hello. I thought I'd talk about what I've read this week, because I actually got a few comics this week. I got the new Suicide Squad Rebirth book, because it's written by Rob Williams, and Rob Williams writes very good comics. The art is by... I believe it's Philip Tan. Hang on. It's the gentleman's surname is Tan. Let me just look up the credits. Sorry, that was unprofessional. Yes, Philip Tan. I am not historically a fan of Philip Tan's artwork, I have to be honest. His figure work can be inconsistent and in a style that I'm not a big fan of. But he's inked by Jonathan Glapion here, and that makes a big difference. It's still, you know, still not my ideal choice, but Glapion is a very good inker and smooths over, or, well, actually, to be honest, roughs up some of the elements that I don't like so much about Tan's artwork and makes them more palatable to me. I'm looking forward to the next issue, the issue one proper, because this is the Rebirth issue one. So then there'll be an issue one of the new series. That's going to be drawn by Jim Lee. I'm one of the people who likes Jim Lee. If you believe what you read online, there's very few of us. And yeah, his stuff seems to sell quite well, so I can't be that unusual. The story's pretty good. It's very much like a done-in-one sort of quick refresher origin thing. It's but it works as such. It sets up the status quo quite nicely. It's the tone is good. It's exactly right for a comic like this. It's very heightened, sort of pulp, very very much getting across, you know, this is about sort of high adventure, but with a gritty sort of... the word that keeps coming to mind is manly. Now, obviously, that's a problematic word, but I think you know what I mean. Machismo is all over this. But Rob Williams is a smart guy. Like that, it's all over this in a smart way. Yeah, it's a good comic. If you like things like Luther, or if you like Batman v Superman, or if you reckon you're going to like the Suicide Squad movie, if you like David Ayer movies, you know, Training Day, End of Watch, Fury, if you like that kind of story with that heightened tone and kind of darkness that's kind of over the top enough that it's actually a form of camp, you'll like this. It's good. I really enjoyed it, actually. It's not mind blowing. It's certainly not the best thing Rob Williams has done. Even like Martian Manhunter, it's something that's going to stand the test of time in a way that this probably won't. But as a disposable action adventure comic book, I really enjoyed it, and I'm looking forward to more. What else did I read? Seeing as I've managed to talk for 4 minutes already and I only talked about one comic, let me have a look. I've got Comixology open in front of me. I've gone fully digital, which is interesting. Punisher. Punisher continues to be good, but not as good as I would like it to be, though I kind of trust Becky Cloonan. After reading Southern Cross, I'm used to this idea that Becky Cloonan maybe... gives the impression in the first few issues of a story of not really knowing where they're going, and then will surprise you. And that seems to be happening here, actually. Very similar tone to Suicide Squad, but much more sort of spare storytelling style. Steve Dillon continues to be an amazing artist. I don't think that's ever going to change, do you? And the colouring continues to bother me. It's you know, more of the same. It's good. If you like it, you like it. And then there's the two comics I really loved this month. Trees by Warren Ellis and is it James Howard? Jason Howard. I love this comic so much. Trees is... like, a lot of people talk about Injection, and Injection is good. But Trees is exponentially better. It helps that the artwork is much, much better on Trees. I mean, I know people like Declan Shalvey and Jordi Belair, and I understand why, but I'm not, personally, not really a big fan. I find Shalvey's artwork a little too reliant on his influences, to be honest. The actual drawing isn't that special, but his... you know, everything that makes his work good is stylistic, and I just see his influences when I look at his art. I just see where those stylistic ticks are coming from, rather than anything coming from him, which is probably... I mean, that's probably unfair. That's probably down to myself being an artist, but yeah. So his work doesn't do very much for me, and I'm not really a fan of Jordi Belair's colouring style either. You know. She's very good, but not in a way that I enjoy particularly. Trees, on the other hand, Jason Howard's artwork is unique. He's amazing. He's a really lively cartoonist. Like there's a real sense of character to his people. You really get what they're feeling and what in this. It's a very sort of sketchy draftsmanship that really gives a lot of feeling and emotion to his work, and he colours himself, and his colours are beautiful. He's a really, really good colourist. does some amazing things with palettes, which is particularly important considering Trees takes place over multiple locations with multiple characters. There aren't many artists and there aren't many colourists who could pull this off, and he does it really well. We shift from location to location all the time without captions to tell us where we are very often. In the early issues, I think there were, but now there aren't. And I don't get lost. And there hasn't been an issue of Trees for quite a long time. But I'm looking. There are sometimes captions to tell you where you are. But as I say, I haven't read Trees for... It's been a few months. And I was not, as I say, not lost at all. Drop right back in. And as I say, it's a very complicated story. It's taking place all around the world with multiple characters going through lots of different things. I'm not going to really say anything about the story, same as I haven't with the other two, really, but I can't say anything. I can't with this one particularly, because it's the last chapter of the second arc, so, you know. But if you haven't read Trees, you should really read Trees. It's about people, and it's about how people adapt to change, which, you know, and to massive social upheaval, and how those things affect different people on different strata of society and so forth. And those are interesting subjects to me. It's a really good piece of science fiction. It reminds me of Kim Stanley Robinson's Mars trilogy. Textually, it's got nothing in common, but I feel like it's treading similar thematic ground. I strongly recommend Trees. I think it's the best thing Warren Ellis is doing at the moment. And then there's Kill or Be Killed by Sean Phillips and Ed Brubaker and Elizabeth Breitweiser. And I am a huge fan of Brubaker and Phillips. I have been for a very long time. You know, Sleeper was amazing. Criminal is amazing. Incognito, the first volume of Incognito is fantastic. The second volume, I think, goes off the rails a little bit. But, you know, the Fade Out, I loved the Fade Out. The Fade Out was one of my favourite comics while that was coming out. I enjoyed Fatal, maybe not quite as much as their other stuff, but, you know, it was very good. I will always read anything they do. This looks really interesting. Sean Phillips is doing some interesting things with storytelling and with panel layouts that we've not really seen him experiment very much with those for a while. He did a little, there was something interesting that happened during Incognito where he tried out some, he brought back some tricks that he used to do in Sleeper. The panel layouts in Sleeper are incredible and really, really clever, and I miss that. With this, he's still using his... all the way through Criminal, he's always used, and through Fatal and through the Fade Out, he uses a traditional three-row panel layout. So like a nine-panel grid where you have three panels, three panels, three panels. You know, three rows of three panels going across a page. It's like that, except that they're not necessarily rows of three panels, but it's almost like three newspaper strips laid out on top of each other to make up each page. That's very much how Fatal works there, and how Criminal works. And they lead to quite simple looking pages, but that are very easy to read. With this, he's still doing that. Most pages have like a larger image that covers most of the page that these strips are then laid on top of, which is similar to a thing he used to do in Sleeper. I could go on at length about what he's doing here, but there's some clever stuff. He's doing some clever stuff with page layout and panel layout. That is a step beyond what he normally does, and it's great. I really like it. The real star of the show for me is Elizabeth Breitweiser. Breitweiser came on to their work partway through Fatal, and she took over from Dave Stewart. So on Fatale, she was kind of keeping Dave Stewart's style going, which, you know, I mean, that's not a bad choice. Dave Stewart is one of the best colorists in the business. You know, of course you would do that. But then with the fade out, we saw her really come into her own with this incredibly painterly style, which I feel like I should clarify. I don't mean painterly in the sense that a lot of computer colorists are painterly, like Dean White, for example, with that very sort of textured, detailed style that turns line art into something that looks almost like an oil painting. I don't mean like that. I mean painterly in the sense that she is not afraid to throw color around. She's not worried about sticking in the lines particularly. She's very much about palette and about light, about the use of light, and where that falls. She's painterly in the way, not in the way that Frank Frazetta is painterly, but painterly in the way that Monet is painterly. She's incredible, and she stepped up a bit more here. I think her colouring on the fade out was absolutely brilliant, and on Velvet as well, because she colours that as well. But this is sort of feels like a levelling up for her. It's hard for me to put my finger on quite why. Colours are not my strongest point, but it's really, yeah, really, really beautiful to look at, this comic book. So yeah, Kill or Be Killed. If I had to do a pick of the week, that would be it. So that's what I've been reading. That's what I read this week. That's what I thought of them. Trees and Kill or Be Killed. Go get them. They're really good. All right. Peace, love, dolphin free tuna. Yeah. See you later. Bye. My screen's locked, so now I have to. Yeah, sorry, that's the sound of me unlocking my screen to turn off the recording. Bloody hell, 14 and a half minutes. I'm sorry, Nick.
Do you ever get that where you feel a bit anxious and you feel like you can't draw a breath and like you just want to yawn, but yawning feels almost, it's not painful, but there's this slight worry that you're going to forget how to breathe midway through, or you're not going to get all of the air out, or you're not taking in enough air and you might pass out. And do you ever get that? Does everyone get that? Is that just, might just be me? Is it just me? I don't know. I guess I could talk about some comics I read this week. So the first one, it's a very slight first issue. I can't remember the name of the publisher. It's a relatively new one, but it's the first issue of a series called Animosity, written by Marguerite Bennett with art by Raphael de la Tour, and it follows in quite a after quite a punky little intro page. It basically follows the situation on our planet Earth. It's like basically where we live right now. But following an event called The Wake, which is effectively the point at which all of the animals on Earth, like all trillions of them, suddenly are able to talk and don't like us. They're unhappy with us. Now, this is an idea that seems to have, like, its time seems to have come. There's a TV show that has a really similar premise, whose name escapes me. Probably something to do with a zoo. There's also a UK indie comic that I talked about a few weeks ago, and the name now escapes me. Really shockingly, vibrant, beautifully illustrated, all set in a zoo. Beast something. Beast. But hang on. I'm going to look it up. Beast Wagon. That's it, Beast Wagon. Which is a similar idea. That's about a revolt of the animals within the zoo. There was also a really cool song about it a few years ago. which I'll put in the show notes.
Phineas, parson of the Canterbury tribe, was king o'er the apes at that time. Brought to Ohio just 2 summers prior, imprisoned but having committed no crime. It was 1979. Phineas Parsec climbed up on his rock and smelled the raw flesh on the arched his silver back and saw the giraffes who were milling about as they pleased. And he knew that they were a disease.
Can't remember who that was by or what it was called either, so I'll share that with you. But it's that was cool too. That was about a revolt in the zoo as well.
Bobo the fucking giraffe, tallest and fairest of all, and Phineas hated him with all of his soul, because Phineas wanted so much to be tall. Bobo didn't notice at all.
The scale of this is quite a bit bigger and it's told in a really different way, but if you heard the premise for this comic and thought, well, that seems to be an idea I've seen somewhere else. Like I said, there are a few stories that seem to be doing this at the moment, and I guess it was only a matter of time before this became a thing, like a little subgenre, animal uprisings or something. The scale of this is really fun, though, and quite exciting. It's the first few pages set it up where you see all of these animals in normal situations, some domestic. There's a cow that's about to be slaughtered. There's some stuff going on at the vets. Just all sorts of different situations. There's a little girl with her dog who will become important later on. She's a little girl called Jessie, and she's got a dog called Sandor. And we see immediately before the wake happens and immediately after when all of the animals have started talking. And there's a lot of humor, but there's a lot of genuine horror in what each of those animals chooses to say and what happens in all of those situations. There's a domestic abuse situation and stuff like that. And it's quite interesting seeing how all of the different animals are characterized. And it's a really nice, you could do it in TV and film as well, but it's something that comics are really, really good at, where you've got one page with all of the animals in one moment and one situation, and then the next page has all of them a moment later when everything's kind of gone to hell. And there are a few different pages that have similar transitions to that, where you see quite slickly, actually, and quite cinematically, you see the situation building where one group of people first discover that animals are sentient. The animals are suddenly sentient and also really, really angry. And then a few pages later, after a couple of nice narrative beats, you're suddenly in the situation where, and I guess it's a fairly typical of zombie outbreak movies or any outbreak movies really, where as people are discovering this is going on, you go from everything's fine and suddenly this one tiny incident happens, and then suddenly you're in a world where some people already know this is happening and are panicking, and other people are discovering it as news and situations feed out. Very quickly, you're in a story where this is the, if not the new normal, where people are just having to deal with it. So, and what I find interesting, what Bennett decides to do here is, and I guess this is going to become a staple of these sorts of stories as well, but seeing which animals decide they're going to help the humans and you know, which animals are loyal to the humans and how all of that characterization happens is really good. There's space for there's a lot of space here for like political or ideological commentary on how awful humans are to animals, and that happens here, but it's never the core thing. For example, Sandor, I don't think it's a spoiler to say, Sandor is the loyal pet of this little girl, Jessie, and immediately takes on a protective role in this world that suddenly switched. You get to see how weird that relationship between a dog owner that loves their dog and the dog is, where in the normal run of things, the human is looking after the dog, but all that it really takes is a quick switch for the dog to be the one who kind of knows what's going on. I don't think I'm spoiling anything to say that. It's really interesting. What's cool though is there's no effort at realism here necessarily, even though the world we're in, I know that sounds ridiculous because I'm talking about animals talking and everything, but in a world where you've got it's our world, it's kind of supposed to be grounded to our world, you do have some pretty wild action that seems a little bit like Hollywood-y, but it really, really works. This first issue is lovely. It delivers some really poignant moments, some really funny moments, some actually horrific moments. You do get a sense of how truly fucked we would be as a species if all of the animals just decided that we didn't deserve to be at the top of the food chain anymore. It's pretty good. As I said, this first issue is very slight, but yeah, it's good.
The gorillas were eating koalas because that's what they really eat. The last living panda acquired a shotgun, and rhinos made love in the streets. The zoo became eerily calm. The cages and walkways ran red. The only survivor, a small baby tiger, looked up at the sky and he said, "The survivors will envy the dead."
There's a new Evil Ernie first issue. Evil Ernie used to be a Chaos comic, and I think various people might have owned the rights to that, but now it sits at Dynamite. It's called Evil Ernie God Eater, number one. It's by Justin Jordan as writer, with art by Colton Worley. And the main reason I read this was because, the art looks really pretty from flicking through it. Quite crazy expressionistic, sort of Ben Temple Smith-esque, but with more realistic proportioned characters and everything, but very sort of nightmarish or dreamlike in that sort of hazy, vague way. But Justin Jordan is a writer that I do quite often enjoy. He can write really earthy horror. And this comic opens on a scene of abuse that has very like early 90s social justice-y aesthetic going on. It reminded me a lot of the social commentary in films and comics like The Crow and things like that, where you get sort of very, very gothic or industrial imagery over and ideology being applied to real world social ills. But so it starts with these two siblings being attacked by their father. Very quickly becomes apparent that one of them is a supernatural entity in a human form, even if they didn't realize it before. And that is going to be quite hokey for some people, but I quite liked the way it was presented here. The dialogue was all very spare and really worked and flowed quite nicely, and the actual art was beautiful. And then we encounter Evil Ernie. Now, I don't really understand Evil Ernie as a character. He very much seems to come out of an effort to address that same early 90s aesthetic I was talking about, but with this level of anarchy and fun that you started to get around the same time. Anarchy and fun and sort of just general arsehole-ishness. People like him, I think, because he's very sweary and anti-establishment. I think he's supposed to be like a teenager or in his early 20s, and he's basically a demon guy. It's really difficult to describe. You've either seen posters of him, or you probably know what he looks like, and that's all you really need to know about this character. He has links to hell, but it isn't required that you really understand all of the backstory. He has this little badge, which I think is meant to be a demon and is really, really powerful, but it's like this little smiley face badge that is even more of an asshole than he is. And he's driving a car, and he's driving it too fast, and just basically being like a young demonic rebel in America, I guess. But very quickly, he encounters someone, and suddenly we're in this situation where I think maybe, and again, this might be being reductive, I think maybe Evil Ernie has always appealed to a sort of a heavy metal album cover sort of horror. Lots of people getting their just desserts and hyper-violence and stuff. But this comic immediately pits him against this very Lovecraftian, creepy, ghostly, possessed existential horror thing that's going on. You see, this is me. I don't really know enough about that sort of hair album horror genre thing, and I don't really know enough about Lovecraft. I'm entirely blagging it. Anyway, the art was really interesting, if quite indistinct sometimes. The writing was perfectly crisp and fine. It's a very generic comic, but it really works within the confines of its genre. It's good. Evil Ernie, God Eater, number one. I liked it. Finally, the only Marvel comic that really appealed to me this week, and certainly the only one of the ones I've read that I really, really enjoyed, is a bit of a surprise to me, in that it is about the most corporate thing it would be possible for Marvel to put out this week. It's Marvel Tsum Tsum, number one. It's written by Jacob Chabot, with art by David Baldian, but really it's by Disney. If you don't have little kids, or you don't spend loads of time on YouTube, or you just generally don't pay much attention to Disney, you won't necessarily know what Tsum Tsums are. They're like these really, you can go on YouTube and see what they are. They're very odd. They were an idea for a sort of toy that makes use of the defining characteristics of different character designs while representing them in this kind of little squashed sausage format. So all of the characters are oblong. They're like these little oblong things. And they're designed to be soft toys. They're designed to be comfort things, I think. You can get them in various different sizes. Nearly all of the Disney characters are represented there. A lot of the Pixar ones. Now loads of the Marvel ones are as well, because obviously they're owned by Disney. They don't make any sense as a character design. What they make sense as is a soft toy. Like, you might want a Stitch from Lilo and Stitch toy, but you want one that you can nicely rest your head on, and that's what these are for. It's recognisably Stitch, but it's also a big, weird, oblong thing that's a soft toy. And that's what Tsum Tsums are. It's spelled T-S-U-M, T-S-U-M. I mean, it doesn't seem to mean anything. I don't know. Anyway, but Disney own Marvel, and Marvel always used to do sort of these corporate toy crossover things anyway. So it just, I guess, made sense to someone that they'd do this. And what they've done is they've actually given the Tsum Tsums a sort of a rationale as this thing that actually exists in the Marvel Universe. They're introduced in this weird little, in media res, incident that we're introduced to, where the Guardians of the Galaxy, as represented by Rocket Raccoon, and it is the sort of comic that has to start, if you're going to have a recognisable character start it, it has to be Rocket Raccoon, because he's little and cute, but kind of anarchic and weird as well. Where the Guardians of the Galaxy are trying to stop some infestation or something that's happening, and they're trying to stop space vehicles from going through, and it's this weird sort of silly old-fashioned thing that could have happened on a New York street in a Marvel comic in the 1980s, where there's a lorry driver who's like, no way, I'm just going to go straight through. And he does, and then this canister gets broken off and then flies towards Earth with no one noticing it. And then we're in the part of the story that's actually set on Earth. And we're quickly introduced to this tower block called the Brick. we're introduced to a group of children who really couldn't have been more cleverly put together as representative of a little group of comic book of story teens. It made me think a little bit of some criticisms people have said about Stranger Things, the Netflix series, in that these kids aren't really, they're an archetype. As a group, they're an archetype. There's the spunky girl called Holly. There's the really nerdy one, even though he does have like a really cool little sort of nerdy mohawk called Bert. And then there's the little black kid called Dunk. It sounds like I'm being reductive, but literally you look at them and they couldn't have been more designed as a representative group. They're all, you know, the characterization of them is really, really cute. They all work fine within those archetypes. I'm sure as the comic unwinds, you'll get to really like each one, even though they could literally be any other similar group of characters from story history. They're super excited by superhero sightings. They sort of stand on the roof of, one of them stands on the roof of their building and they're tracking, I can see Iron Man, he's coming, and like Iron Man goes over and then they all like run down to the street and they're trying to take photos. They're like superhero spotters. And into this, they end up finding this canister that just drops on, I think it drops on their roof, I can't really remember. And they take that canister down to their room, they're trying to open it, and they open it and it's got these little oblong blobs in it. Who are really super cute. They're like little cuddly soft things. They're the Tum Tums. You know, they're the Tum Tums. And very quickly, loads of plot happens that ends up with these Tum Tums having the characteristics of some of the Marvel superheroes. And that's the conceit. I mean, it's stupid. It really is stupid. But it's really fun. I don't know how it would play to someone who was the age I was when I was reading comics like this in the 80s. I don't know if young teenagers are more cynical now, really, but it's got loads of characteristics that seemed instantly familiar to me. There's drama without too much gravitas. There's a lot of fun. The kids like bounce off each other and their environment really, really nicely. There's some really generic comic art. It's quite cartoony and frenetic the way it's drawn, but there's some quite generic comic art within that style, but at the same time there's some really nice transitions and nice moments where they've clearly worked. So they want the block of flats that they live in, the brick, to be this environment that you're very aware of where everything fits, and that's actually used in really interesting ways in some of the storytelling. Some of the page layouts are really, really nice, considering the amount of frenetic information that's going on. The comic's chaotic. The Tum Tums are chaotic little creatures. There are moments where there is an element of drama is introduced, but it's all low level. The stakes seem really low at this point. And one thing that I really liked, but I think will just really annoy people, is there's this return to... And maybe it's been happening in comics all along. It probably has been happening in comics all along, but I'm not a teenager anymore, so I don't notice it. The way they talk is how a writer who, I mean, I'm assuming Jacob Chabot is a guy, at the very earliest he's in his late 20s probably, but he's writing teens and they're talking like teens. And so I was reading it and thinking, this is just like in the 80s where someone would write teenagers. And it seems kind of, I think for an English person reading it, you always thought, maybe this is what American teenagers talk like. But I'm not actually convinced that that's the case. I think it might be a little bit ridiculous. But for a 43-year-old, it seemed familiar to the experience of reading those sorts of comics back then. And it was so fun. I didn't really care that they didn't talk like normal teenagers. It was just nice seeing this cute group of teenagers having cute adventures. It was good. I liked it. Incredibly corporate. I feel a bit dirty now for liking it so much. But yeah, I did. Sorry, the world's not that much fun at the moment. I'm trying to make the most of it. So that's that. That's it for another week. I think this is probably quite a short, slight episode, really. But that's us. Sometimes it's a bit like this. We don't like to be pinned down. We like to be unpredictable. That's us. Sometimes we can't even predict what we ourselves are going to do. It's exciting. Oh, while I remember, the episode of Stacey's Pop Culture Parlor, the 24-hour live charity show that was for the Alzheimer's charity, the episode with James and I on went up this week. I'll put a link to that in the show notes as well as to the charity. It's worth listening to all of those episodes, though. Stacey got some amazing people on it. Also, the Geek Syndicate guys did, I think it might actually have been their latest episode, was a video episode, and it looks really good, and they are a really natural fit for that. I've been looking at those guys a lot recently and thinking, it must be lovely. You can really get a sense that they've basically known each other since they were tiny little kids, parkouring around London or whatever it is tiny little kids do in London. Or did in London back in the 70s and 80s. I always lived in rubbish suburban satellite cities. I think it was a very different experience. But yeah, it's really fun. I definitely recommend that, and I'll put a link to that in the show notes too. Remember, patreon.com/TOTP if you want to support us. At the moment, the pound and the dollar are like vying against each other for superiority, and I think the pound's losing. I think that works out okay for us, especially if you're not in the UK and you decide to patronize us. Yes, thank you to all of the people who already are doing that. Thank you to all of our listeners. You're all lovely, especially in these turbulent times. And thank you to our contributor, and see you next week. Speak to you next week.